Mode One. This is Diana DeVoe, and you're listening to Alan Roger Curry, a.k.a. the King of Verbal Seduction, right here on the Erotic Conversationalist.
I used to be scared of the dick. Now I don't look for the shit. Here's the dick, a real bitch. Have a hunter, get a jacket, take it in the bunk.
The following internet radio show is for mature audiences only. That means, boys and girls, you must be 18 years of age or older to listen.
How many of you have ever wondered what it would be like to work in the adult film industry? Quite obviously, you have to be the antithesis of a prude and or a camera-shy personality. But like any other industry, creating, producing, and distributing adult films is a business. And my guest this evening knows the adult film industry inside and out due to the fact that she's worked both as a performer and she's made history as the industry's first African-American female director. Who is this talented, business-savvy woman? Her real name is April, but everyone in the adult film industry knows her by the stage name Diana DeVoe. And right now, you're about to enter into the erotic zone with yours truly, Alan Roger Curry, the King of Verbal Seduction. This is The Erotic Conversationalist.
I'm sort of weird in that if I find somebody that I like performing with, I didn't want to hang out with them socially because I would be afraid I'd find out something like just stupid or goofy about them that would make it impossible for me to really take them seriously the next time we work together. So you knew I liked working with you, but I would just like never hang out with you ever.
So you love having Nina lick your pussy and you like licking her pussy.
Hold on. We're getting off track from the actual question, which, I mean, I can't even remember right now, but it was something. The point is, you are distracting me, and I don't want to just, you know, start stroking my pussy right now or anything.
You don't want to start stroking what?
I said, I don't want to start stroking my pussy right now or anything. I need to answer the question. I don't even know what the question was. You got me messed up right now.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the premiere episode of The Erotic Conversationalist. My name is Alan Roger Curry. Now, most of you listening know me as the author of Mode One, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking, and my second book, Up Front and Straightforward, Let the Manipulative Game Players Know What You're Really Thinking. But here I'm kind of deviating from my sort of mainstream PG-13 persona, and I'm adopting more of a risque, adult-themed. If anyone saw the movie Sex, Lies, and Videotape, you'll recall one of the most memorable characters was played by James Spader, and his character was named Graham Dalton. Graham Dalton had a fetish, for lack of a more appropriate term. He had a fetish for getting women to come on videotape and open up with their innermost erotic thoughts and past sexual experiences and sexual fantasies, etc. So if I had to kind of compare my role on this show to someone, it would be the fictional character of Graham Dalton, only my medium is not going to be videotape, it's going to be audiotape. And just over the last probably 15 years or so, many women who I've come in contact with, conversed with, generally interacted with, they've always encouraged me, actually, to create a show such as this. They say, Alan, you have a natural talent for making women feel comfortable opening up about anything and everything related to their innermost erotic desires, their overall sensuality, their past sexual experiences, their most desirable sexual fantasies. So I've decided to take that and run with it. I kind of got the nickname the Erotic Conversationalist from a few female friends who know about my phone sex history. Some people don't get into phone sex. I had an ex-girlfriend turn me out to phone sex. So since the early to mid-90s, I've now had phone sex with probably 1,200 women. And other than just getting my pleasure in those conversations, I learn a lot. I'm a good listener, and I learn a lot about women's sexuality. So that's kind of my backstory of why I wanted to do this show. And in my premiere episode, I wanted to have someone from an industry that tends to attract a lot of controversy, a lot of positive comments as well as negative comments. And in many ways, this is an industry that is enigmatic to a lot of people. Only those who work in the industry know the ins and outs of the adult film industry. That's what I'm speaking of, the adult film industry. And so the young lady I invited for my premiere episode is a woman who not only established herself as a performer beginning with 1999, but beginning with 2002, she became the very first, bold and italicized letters, the very first African-American female director in the adult film industry. Her resume is so long, I don't even want to highlight the various movies that she's worked on and directed, but I want to welcome to my premiere episode of The Erotic Conversationalist, Miss Diana DeVoe. How are you this evening, Diana?
I am doing wonderfully, and even more so after that great introduction. You made me sound so important. I love it.
You are important. You are important. I don't have scrubs on my show. Yeah, I try to go for the people who've achieved significant things. And actually, where you caught my eye, I've jacked off to quite a few of your films. And
glad to be of service.
thank you. The pleasure was all mine. I actually think I fucked while you were playing on the TV.
Wow.
Yeah, when I looked at, because I kind of did, after I invited you, I kind of looked at different films you were in as a performer. And then I was like, oh, no, I know her. Yeah, I just didn't know your name at the time. But
oh, yeah. That's that one.
Yeah.
That's every porn star's name, by the way, that one. All of JJ's might as well be that.
Yeah.
Different last name. That one with the, with, you know, with the long weave, with the one red curl, that one that turned her head like this. Yeah.
Let's keep it real, as I'm going to do on all my episodes of this show. Brothers, I don't know about white dudes, you know, white dudes are kind of different breed. My white male friends, they big on tits, or as they call it, the rack, other different features. Brothers, the first thing we care about, particularly as it relates to adult film, is does the sister got a nice ass? And you most undoubtedly have a nice ass.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, I think that's what would catch your eye. But with all due respect to your career as a performer, what actually made me, though, want to invite you on the premiere episode of The Erotic Conversationalist was when I read an article by a gentleman named Anthony Springer, Jr. He interviewed you, and you were just breaking some shit down in that interview. See, just in the same way physically a nice ass turns me on, I love women who are intelligent and articulate and just break some shit down. And, yeah, just reading that article, I was like, oh, damn. I've got to have her on the show.
Oh, I got you each way coming, huh?
Oh, man, yeah, you got me with the ass, the intelligence.
Oh,
not
see,
to mention,
you like
ain't hard on the eyes.
I love it.
Yeah, so I said, I got to. I wrote Nina, because Nina hardly was on my more mainstream PG-13 show, even though we got risque at different points in the conversation. But I had actually met Nina when I lived in Los Angeles for 6.5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I was actually at one point looking to break into the adult film industry.
Yeah, I know this is breaking all rules of interviewee etiquette, but I need to know, what was your primary reason?
I wasn't actually looking to perform. There was a woman I used to date, and she was the first one who turned me on to phone sex. We would have phone sex on a regular basis. And she started kind of juicing on my head. She was like, Alan, you're really good at this phone sex thing. Hmm. You know, I was kind of like, get the fuck out of here. Who can be good at phone sex? You know, he's talking about fucking. She said, no, you have a particular style.
Hmm.
And she said, I'm going to refer you to some of my girlfriends. So she had me have phone sex with like 4 or 5 of her girlfriends.
Wow.
And they loved me. Then they started requesting that I write erotic fantasies along with the phone sex.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons I even came up with the idea for this show was because so many women over the last roughly 15 years or so, said, Alan, you have a knack, or I wouldn't even go as far as say as a talent for getting women to open up and talk about sexual issues. Because, like, I'd be at house parties or anywhere, and mm-hmm. I'd meet a woman at 8 o'clock, and by 10 after 8, me and her were talking about fucking. That's actually how my book came
about. I'm guessing
about.
That comes in handy every once in a while, huh?
I have a book out called Mold One, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking. And that's actually the backstory of my book is that when I was in college, I went to Indiana University in Bloomington.
Mm-hmm.
And I would approach women and just say the most boldest, sexually provocative, straightforward shit that any man on campus would ever say.
There's always that one guy.
And women would be like, oh, my God, I don't believe you just said that. And
but
honestly, a lot of them would give me a negative reaction initially, keyword, initially.
Mm-hmm.
But then once they saw I wasn't going to back down from what I said, I wasn't going to apologize, they would just be like, he's so bad.
I'm not surprised. Definitely some provocative stuff that gets said.
I just actually admitted this a month ago or so on my Facebook page and it raised my eyebrows. But yeah, I used to, at one point, I had like at least 25 to 30 female clients that I used to write erotic fantasy for. And that's when people, or at least a handful of them, start saying, Alan, I know the porno industry is not really known for its storytelling and, you know, but
right.
You ought to try to become like a screenwriter in adult film industry because you have such an imagination. You come up with these very hot scenarios. So I took that advice and ran with it. And just so happened, they were advertising in a magazine called The Learning Annex.
Mm-hmm.
It said Nina Hartley is leading a workshop called How to Break into the Adult Film Industry. So that's how she and I met, even though for the most part, she was basically like, Alan, don't do it.
Right, right.
Because she said on the standpoint of writing, directing, and producing, she this was her word, she said it was kind of a good old boys club.
Yes,
it and
is.
She said unless I had my own financing resources, that it would be hard to break in as particularly no real directing experience.
Told you correctly. And I'm going to amend her statement. If you have the blessing of the old boy network, it is not necessary at all to have any directing experience. They would actually prefer that you didn't.
Really?
And I know that that sounds crazy. But, and this is, I'm getting into the angry black woman thing. I promise. I'm going to keep it to a minimum. But when you have a group of people who are not necessarily the most qualified to do business, they don't want someone in their midst who is.
Mm-hmm.
Because the best thing that they can do at that point is to keep out people who are smarter than they are.
Interesting.
And,
okay, well, we're going to touch on that in a little bit, come back to the whole angry sister edge.
Not that it's really not angry black women.
I don't know if I ever met a sister that grew up in Hawaii. How was that experience? I mean, you have something in common with our current president. I mean,
yes,
you're a native of Hawaii. How was it growing up in Hawaii?
Well, I can sum it up to you with this. I was the only person, you know, besides my family, that I had ever seen with a jerry curl. Imagine that at, you know, when you're a teenager and all you want to do is fit in anyway, and you're the only black person in a school of 2,500, and, you know, so there's all that, and, you know, well, how come your hair is so greasy, and you can't go to swim class like everybody else? It's hard being different when you are an adolescent anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it compounds it when you literally go weeks without seeing anyone who looks like you.
Mm-hmm.
So and I read Dreams of My Father by Barack Obama, and I really identified with it because he really encapsulated it. And for him, it was worse because being a black man is totally a whole different kettle of fish from being a black woman, obviously. You know, there's different issues and whatever and different fights that we have to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like being on a planet where you think you're the alien, certainly, because everyone else is normal. And they're looking at you like, what's wrong with you? I'm not going to say it was horrible. I definitely would have turned out a lot differently, maybe, you know, good or bad, had I grew up someplace else. But it definitely had an effect on my brother and I.
You have one sibling?
Yeah, Younger brother.
Okay. How old were you when you lost your virginity?
I was 15 or 16 years old. And again, this is all going to go, now that you know my whole background in terms of growing up as like the only black girl ever, there was like one other black girl at my school actually, still friends with her to this day, but she grew up mostly on the mainland. So, you know, she came there for high school and whatnot, went back to the mainland for college. So I don't really count that because she didn't, you know, get it since birth. But I was 15 or 16 years old and I got like zero play in high school.
Really?
Nobody wanted to date me. Nobody, because I was different, you know.
Mm.
And people, you know, at that age, you know, they want to conform. They just do. It just is what it is. You don't want to be the weird one with, you know, the shirt from, you know, 10 years ago or anything like that. You want to have all the stuff your friends have. And that doesn't include a black girl on your arm. So I was at the mall, and the black people that I did run into were primarily military, because there's obviously a lot of military over there. The white people that I ran into were primarily military. So, you know, I've run into them at the mall, whatever. I developed rather early. I don't even think the guy really knew when he started talking to me how old I was. He was, I think, 21 or 22. And I already knew I wanted to leave Hawaii to go to college. I needed to get away. And I wanted to have certain experiences before I left. And I was afraid of sex completely. Like,
really?
I was one of those that listened to the after-school special, and, you know, your boobs are going to fall off if you have sex, and it's the most horrible thing, and don't do it, blah, blah, blah. So I was like, you know what, if I go to college a virgin, and I go to some strange place, I'm never going to get it done. So this guy is feeling me, whatever, you know, I don't really care about him, so why don't I just get it over with? And those were the circumstances under which I lost my virginity. And, of course, under those circumstances, it wasn't a lot of fun. It normally isn't for most women their first time. It's actually rather painful. And I was like, okay, well, that's sex. I didn't die. I didn't get pregnant. All right, let's move it along. And I didn't have sex again for 3 years, something
really?
Like that. Yeah.
Wow. 3-year hiatus, huh?
It's really not that long.
She is.
I mean, I did have a vibrator.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it wasn't really that long.
It wasn't. So, yeah, those were the circumstances under which I lost my virginity. Let me go on and get it on over with. You know, now you hear today about these women who are selling their virginity on eBay and whatnot, and, you know, part of me thinks, like, wow, you were kind of dumb. You should have went and wrote it out, dude. You could have had a nice little nest egg. What's wrong with you?
Now,
incidentally, ended up not going away to school. Ended up going to University of Hawaii, which is a whole other story. I mean, hey, I met some people that were going to influence what I ended up doing. So it was a good thing in retrospect.
Oh, okay.
But I was sorely disappointed. I was supposed to go to Georgetown.
You wanted to go to Georgetown?
I was accepted at Georgetown.
Oh, okay. Great. But what made you end up staying at University of Hawaii?
Money.
Oh.
I got like 17 grand in scholarships and aid, but at that time, Georgetown was 24 grand a year, plus flying there, moving expenses, trips home for Christmas, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it just was not going to work out.
At what age did you see your first adult film?
I was maybe 14. I think, when I saw my first adult film. But I have to preface that, and if you want me to give another example, I will after this. So, movie Edward Scissorhands, right, with Johnny Depp. Remember it? Winona Ryder, blah, blah, blah. He had the scissorhands came down. Everybody knows the movie. There's a parody called Edward Penishands. And I loved that movie Edward Scissorhands. When it came out, I saw it like 14 times in the theater or something dumb like that, whatever. My dad had the parody. And so my mom thought it would be a goof. She goes, oh, my God, I'm not going to let you watch this whole thing, but you have to see this. So she actually, she paused it so it was still frame, and she showed me, like, just a shot of him coming down the stairs. And let me tell you, they didn't mind spending money on prosthetics back then. It was actually really nicely done. The guy was coming downstairs with all the penises. And so that was my first exposure to adult movies. So the short answer is my mom showed me one, but not really, because those were the circumstances under which she did.
See, I like that you and her had that type of relationship where she would be willing to do that.
But it was only because it happened to be a parody of something that I loved. And she just thought it was hilarious. But, yeah, it's not like we sat around like, you know, oh, hey, let's go to, what are we going to rent this weekend? What are we going to sit around and watch? Where's the popcorn? No. No, not at all.
Now, what attracted you to stripping?
Actually, very poor body image in high school. And I was quite the tomboy. And so
really?
When I got to college, oh, yeah, when I got to college, stripping for me was not only a way to supplement income. I had an on-campus job, blah, 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 all that. And when the club was full, I could do my homework there, which was awesome. It was charm school. I learned to put on makeup, learned to walk in heels, learned how to talk to people, because to this day, I'm not excellent at it, you know. Some people can just, you know, sell ice to an Eskimo. I'm not one of those people. But it did, it taught me manners, and it taught me how to be feminine, tomboyish growing up. And I knew that I couldn't be a tomboy all my life, but I wasn't really I actually thought I was pretty ugly, only because my mother, being a teacher, put more of an emphasis on education than this is how you put on makeup, this is how you walk in heels and whatnot. So I was like, ooh, I think she's saying in code that I'm not going to get no rich husband, so I need to study these books. So that's, and it's not that she was saying that at all, but that's what I thought, with, you know, poor body image and what have you. So stripping actually taught me all that. It taught me how to interact with people. It taught me, you know, it taught me confidence, taught me to walk in heels. So it was charm school for me. And it might sound really weird, but I was painfully shy growing up. So it really, it filled me out, and it released my inhibitions about not sex, or not just sex, but just general life. I stopped caring what everyone was thinking about me at every given time. And I don't know if you remember this, but there's a point in most of our adolescent lives where we think all eyes are on us. Like, if we trip over a rock, everyone in the school saw it, and we're just going to die. And it got me out of that. I became very, so what?
Interesting. You mentioned earlier that going to the University of Hawaii, you ended up meeting some connections that I'm assuming ultimately led to your adult film industry career. How did these people you met, how did they influence you to want to make an entryway into the adult film industry?
Well, this is what happened. What had happened was, in my freshman year, I met Alexander DeVoe, who I ended up being, you know, being involved with. We had an 8-year relationship, and he and I also worked at a porn store, and I was dancing. So we were kind of, so I was kind of surrounded with it. And while I was at the store, you know, we'd have movies playing, and I'm like, why are these so bad? I had switched my major from print journalism to public relations. And I was also taking video production and whatnot. We didn't have film school at UH, but the closest I could get was video production and what have you. So learning the basis of that, I was like, why? How have I been making money off this stuff and it looks so bad? Surely they're just waiting for me to come to L.A. and save them. So that must be it. And especially black product at the time. I'm like, God, this stuff is horrible. Can I get a white balance? You know, why are you shaking the camera that much? Why, you know, why does this girl have broken toenails, et cetera, et cetera? And, of course, not to say that there isn't white porn like that, but we're always critical, more critical of ourselves, because we want people that look like us or people that represent us to look better and be better. So me and Alexander DeVoe, we decided we're going to take this industry by storm. So before we came to L.A., after we graduated, we actually produced and directed a whole movie back in Hawaii, you know, shot it on the beach, all that stuff. We brought it to L.A. wanting to shop it for distribution. And because we weren't part of the network, people were like, well, we'll buy you out, but we're not, you know, we're not going to give you a distribution deal. Who are you? Blah, blah, blah.
Wow.
And we were like, we're here now, we're ready to direct, because you must know your shit is horrible, and we're here to help you. So what you need to do, and they were like, no, we make lots of money. Do you see the nice cars outside? That's from our shitty-ass shit that you're saying is so shitty. So
Wow. Guess
we don't need you too much, because we've got Porsches and Lotuses and Lamborghinis. So good luck to you. Long story short, when I would go in to meetings, they would be like, well, do you perform? I'm like, well, I don't have a problem with it, because I would never have somebody perform in front of the camera and at the same time turn my nose up at it. But, you know, poor body image thing. I was like, who the hell wants to pay to see me have sex? And sure, you just. And when I figured out I was actually in demand, I said, well, I can use this to my advantage. I'm going to give myself 3 years. I'm going to perform. I'm going to build my name up as a performer. And if after that I can't do what I really want to do, then I'll do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I set out to do. And what I did was, every time somebody would hire me to do a scene, I, you know, say, here's my rate and blah, blah, blah. However, as a condition of me doing the scene, you have to allow me to shoot camera for another scene for you, but I'll do it for free. And I worked for free for 3 years. And so I noticed in the introduction, you said I had started directing in 2002. I actually started directing in 1997, 2 years before I got to L.A.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
So I was directing before I was performing, but I was not credited, because at the time it was not very in vogue to have a female director. They were like, oh, well, you know, that's not something a girl can do, period.
Interesting. Wow, that's a fascinating story, actually.
Yeah, so, you know, the struggle.
The what?
I said, you know, the struggle and feel my pain is so funny. Someone else had mentioned I was the first black female, and they're like, yeah, you're like Obama. I'm like, could you please not say that, dude? I don't think. I really don't want to compare myself to a black president here. Not so much.
When you make the jump into this, and it's not, let's be real, it's not like pursuing a career as a dentist or a conventional salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
You say you have a younger brother, and you sound like you were raised in a pretty healthy environment. What was the reaction of, say, relatives, close friends, high school and college classmates, when they found out you were embarking on a career in the adult film industry?
Well, I left Hawaii, which most of my classmates didn't do. And so I grew up in Van Nuys, and I saw my classmates every day. Most of my extended family I am not familiar with. Again, being in Hawaii, I was really cut off from them. Everybody else had extended family, you know, cousins and all this stuff, and I didn't have that. So, and I don't have any children. So, I mean, it was my parents. My dad is a fan of porn. So he was like, well, everyone I'm watching is somebody's son or somebody's daughter, so it would be hypocritical of me to go, you know, go left on you, at the same time be safe and whatever. My mom, I actually didn't tell for a long time.
Hmm.
Because, you know, mothers are different. You got to treat them with kid gloves. But
that's interesting to me. So you, see, I would almost, and I guess this is just what I think, I would almost think it would be the opposite. But you're saying it was easier to tell your dad than your mom.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My dad is just a lot more liberal.
Interesting. You're the second woman who I've read. Well, I'm sure there are a number of them, but I remember, I don't know this woman's name, but there was a sister who posed when I lived in L.A. She posed with Playboy.
Mm-hmm.
And she had essentially the same story. Whoever was interviewing, I asked her about, like, what did her parents think about her being a centerfold. And she said she didn't even tell her mom. She asked her dad for the
dad before
she
was in it.
And the dad, he was cracking jokes. He was like, he was a firefighter. He was like, man, I don't want my coworkers looking at my daughter jacking off, looking at your pussy. And she was like, oh, Dad. He was like, okay, yeah, you got my blessings. Go ahead, do a good job.
Yeah, my dad's a policeman. And so policemen and firefighters are particularly, they're perverts, you know, by and large. It's just that profession. And I think it has something to do with the downtime that they have. You know, especially firefighters, but a policeman too. It's like, okay, what is there to do but talk about women, watch porno, talk about women some more, debate whose ass is biggest or what have you. So I think that's where that comes from. My mother is an elementary school teacher, so she has a little bit, she's a little bit more reserved.
Yeah.
I mean, not, you know, completely Bible thumping or anything, but yeah. She wasn't thrilled because she didn't understand that I was trying to build something, and I wasn't just trying to say, well, you know, I finished college, and I'm just going to, you know, float around for a little bit. And it, no, it wasn't. This was a career. This was something that I felt I had a future in, that I thought I was good at, which was the producing and directing movies. I mean, apparently I was a good performer, people liked it, whatever, but that wasn't my primary focus. And being somebody outside of the industry, of course, she didn't see that. She didn't see it until I bought my first house and brought her over, and then she got it.
I like the way you said that. Then she got it.
Yeah, she was like, oh, okay. Because no matter what I told her, until, you know, she saw it, she saw there was a tangible result, positive result, you know, she wasn't. And it's not to say that she was still like, you know, I'm not celebrating how you accomplished this, but I understand what you're trying to do. And I'm not, you know, sitting at home just fervently wishing you were doing something else anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to support you as much as my conscience allows me as your mother to do it. And that's completely fair. One thing about this business is, we live in a pseudo-puritanical society. It's cool to frown upon sex. It's cool to look down on people who are in the sex industry. And we have to know that. I mean, look at the recent political scandals with adultery and whatnot.
What do you think about our contemporary American society that is so sexually duplicitous and erotically hypocritical, particularly towards the adult film industry? I mean, there are many people who publicly will curse you guys and say you guys are corrupting, you know, the hearts and souls of America and smut. But then privately, damn near everybody's watching.
Absolutely.
And so you being in the industry, does that like sometimes just like kind of frustrate you or rile you up, like all these hypocrites out here?
It doesn't. And I'll tell you something. I don't affiliate myself completely with Democrats or Republicans, but I will say that under both Bush administrations, the adult industry was thriving because that's when you have the pseudo-family values and everyone's trying to be so pure and wholesome. And as soon as you tell somebody they can't have a piece of candy, that's all they think about. And so the more conservative this country tries to behave outwardly, the better it is for business, the better it is for all levels of the business, whether that be prostitution, adult video, phone sex, what have you.
Man, that's
you know, because
a great point.
What is forbidden is cool.
Man, that's a damn good point. Huh.
Adult movies do not make as much money in pretty much all of Europe combined as it does in the United States.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, they've got beaches with boobs out. They put full funnel on their network television. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, I've heard about that from friends of mine. Like when I lived in L.A., I had a lot of friends that were from Europe, particularly France. And that's what I've talked about on my other show, is that most Europeans look at Americans as either prudes or, at minimum, as you call them, disingenuous or pseudo-prudes, whereas they would tell me how open, you know, they were over there. And,
mm-hmm.
and so it's interesting. What type of unique mentality does a man or a woman have to make a career in the adult film industry?
Well, first of all, to be in any form of entertainment, where it's, especially when you're up front, I mean, even fiction authors really have an element of, look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me. I didn't get enough attention as a child. I have something to show you. I have a story to tell. Please, I want your attention. Look at me. You know, and so anyone who pursues a career in acting and music and dance and in porn has that element. And that right there is an imbalance. So what I'm saying is that that once you come to L.A. or New York, what have you, to be in front of the cameras in any way, you're already crazy. You know, you're like level one crazy. And then add like 4 or 5 steps to someone who wants to get naked and have sex in front of the camera. Because we pretty much anyone who was born and raised in America has been taught, you don't do that. Nudity is not something you share. You close the door when you use the bathroom. You close the door when you're changing. You know, you don't waggle your ding-dong out the window while we're driving. You know, you don't do those things. And so we're going against everything that we have been taught from birth. And to do that, again, takes a special kind of crazy.
You know, that's funny because I don't really want to quote it because I don't remember her exact words. I would be paraphrasing. But years back when Arsenio Hall was still on the air, Roseanne Barr, the comedian, she made some comments that were very much along the lines of what you just said. She said that anybody who pursues a career in the public eye and has a desire and or expectation of fame are dealing with some insecurities. She went on to say that they are basically people who need a lot of attention to one degree or another, and they need the ego stroke constantly. And again, I can't remember exact words. I don't want to misquote her, but she essentially said that you really can't be a quote-unquote normal person and pursue a career in entertainment or anything that involves, you know, being in the public eye and getting adulation, et cetera.
You can't.
And I found it interesting.
Abnormal.
So for you to echo those same sentiments is interesting.
It's an abnormal situation. Adult is, of course, we know how abnormal that is. But even in quote-unquote mainstream, to just the degree to which your looks, your particular talent is scrutinized, is judge every minute of every day. And not only are you judged, because of course you're judged walking down the street. Oh, she's got a cute shirt. Oh, no, she's ugly. Whatever the case. But that doesn't necessarily affect your bottom line. It doesn't affect how you eat. You know, if you're at the bus stop and somebody don't like your shoes and you're going to McDonald's, it doesn't affect how you eat. But if you're on the front cover of a magazine, you know, drunk and falling out of a cab, it does. So when aesthetics are everything, and then you tie that into your financial well-being, which is very closely tied to your physical and your mental well-being, you've got a cool combination for crazy. When you are working, you're beautiful and everyone loves you. When you're not working, you're the ugliest person in the world and you should probably just kill yourself.
Interesting. As a director and a former performer, what would you say are the top three factors that contribute to a sizzling hot scene?
I would say that the casting comes first. And my thing is I will ask the woman who she'd like to have sex with. It sounds super revolutionary, right? But most directors don't do it. It's, hey, this dude's my homie, or this dude is giving me a deal on a scene, or whatever the case. And so you're going to work with this dude, and you're going to like it, and screw you.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly screw you if you say, you know, I would rather work with XYZ person, especially if I don't happen to like XYZ person.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's more important for me to have my buddy on the set than it is for me to have a hot scene.
Gotcha.
Don't ask why, because I don't know. So my first thing, and this is like 85% of the job, who would you like to work with? Give me five names in case, you know, this person's booked this day, what have you. Mm-hmm. And I'll try to work it on out. Now, the girl is excited for the scene. She feels like she has some level of control. She gets there. She wants to have sex with the guy. She's attracted to the guy. In my opinion, the most basic, simplest, easiest thing you can do to have an 85% chance of a hot scene is just ask the girl who she wants to work with. You know, I don't force anybody on anybody. You know, there's certain guys, obviously, that are under contract or whatever the case that I cannot get. But if a girl gives me a list of five guys, I'll usually be able to get one. And that's, you know, that's a lot of the work done right there, because I know already there's going to be chemistry. If the girl picks a guy, she feels good. She, you know, she has some measure of control over the situation. She knows what to expect when she gets there. Either she's done this guy before and she liked it, or she wants to do this guy. She hasn't done it before, and that's great, too, because it's the anticipation. And then even if the guy isn't really into the girl, you know, maybe she's not quite his type, he's going to be into her simply because she's in him. Guys are very conveniently amenable that way. It's like, hey, she liked me, so I went ahead and did it. I don't know. I didn't really like her, but she was kind of on my nuts. So that's really the most important thing. And after that, it's just keeping your environment friendly and safe. And when I say safe, not like, oh, no knife fights, but there are many directors who don't like their jobs.
Really?
They act like they're working at the Postal Service or something. And so everything is, well, wait, hurry up. Oh, you stupid bitch, this and this, this, that, and third. And it's just not, you know, it's not a positive environment. And maybe they don't even know what they want out of the scene. They just know you're not bringing it right now, and they're just going to yell at you. And so if you just give people an idea of what you want and then, you know, confirm with them that they can give it to you. And if they can't, well, we'll cancel the scene. Good luck, and perhaps another time. But, yeah, you give them, you pair them up, you give them the information, you communicate with them, and you let them go. And I found by doing that that I have an astounding success rate versus other directors. There's some male talent particularly that everyone swears, oh, I never use him. He can't keep his dick hard. He can't this. He can't that. And literally, these particular guys have no problem on my set.
Interesting. That says something about you.
Well, wow. I make myself, I practice being the easiest person to shoot for. Because why make it hard? Why?
I play on words.
Yeah.
Now, I can tell you right off that no one's in there that does it for me. In both adult films, you know, I can't think of one I've seen recently that had this kind of. I love, and I think a lot of men would probably back me up on this, I love a scenario where, like, the first two-thirds, three-fourths of a film, a woman is acting like a bitch, a prude, or a combination of both, and then the man ends up breaking her down and turns out and just fucks the shit out of her. That, man, that's like my one. I mean, there's a lot of scenarios I enjoy and I used to write about when I did my writing fantasies. But that's one in particular that I love.
That's a popular one.
Yeah.
And I can probably tell you why it's so popular. Because men want to believe that they are the catalyst to sex. It goes back to what we were talking about before.
So you see, basically what you just said is that men are fooling themselves. But
and I said before, they're not. It's women who, you know, unless it's obviously like a rape situation going on, that is why people end up having sex, because the woman wants to have sex with the guy, whether, again, she admits it to herself or not.
I got to tell you, with all due respect, Diana, I have criticisms of contemporary porn.
So do I. Let's share. We probably have the same ones. Please.
Here's the thing.
Go right ahead.
If I love the porn from the 70s and 80s.
Mm-hmm.
As I think I told you earlier, I have a book out called Mold One, Let the Women Know What You're Really Thinking. And actually, one of the movies, and more specifically, a fictional character that had a large influence on that book, and I would say my behavior that led to the book, there's a movie called Talk Dirty to Me. It was made in 1980. And matter of fact, one year, GQ magazine ranked it in the top 10 best adult films ever made.
Hmm.
And it centers around this guy named Jack, played by John Leslie, who's, I'm sure you would agree, an adult film industry legend.
Absolutely.
You familiar with John Leslie?
Very.
Oh, okay. I knew there was a reason I invited you on the show. And he plays this slacker womanizer who just goes up to women and says the most bold, blatantly, sexually straightforward shit I'd ever heard. I mean, at the time I saw that film, I literally can say I had never seen a guy talk to women that they didn't know like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just like, oh, man, you mean you can actually get away with that shit? Because what I also learned from watching that movie, I learned about women's duplicity, that a lot of women, because they've been socially conditioned to present themselves as the proverbial good girl, they'll initially give you that reaction like, oh, my God, I don't believe you're talking to me like that, blah, 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 blah. But if they're attracted to you to one degree or another, that kind of talk is going to get their pussy wet.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, I don't want to get all into the storyline of the movie. What I was going to generally say about movies from the 70s and 80s is that, to me, they were like watching mainstream R-rated films that just happened to have explicit sex scenes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I enjoyed them. Because one thing about me, I've had some females lightheartedly tease me at times. And, you know, I might be a sex addict or bordering on a sex addict. But what I always correct them and say, I don't think I'm really an addict in any respect. But if I am, I'm more of a seduction addict and an arousal addict.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the films, they set up sex scenes very well. You know, they build up to like this crescendo where you just couldn't wait to watch the people fuck.
Absolutely.
Whereas nowadays, and I know, and I'm going to ask you about this, I know we're dealing with kind of a different demographic audience. But nowadays, most of them, people just like come in the room and just start fucking.
Mm-hmm.
There ain't no real seduction going on. Now, would you say that's because we live in what I refer to as the microwave oven generation, and they too impatient, they want everything fast and quick? How would you say, generally, in your opinion, how the adult film industry has changed over the last 15, 20 years?
I think that, first of all, you said a mouthful. But now I'll go back to that movie, Talk Dirty to Me. I haven't seen it, but, you know, based on your description of it, I pretty much get it. Now, you looked at that and said, A, I believe that this guy doesn't know these women that he's talking this crazy stuff to.
Mm-hmm.
And that suspension of disbelief is big in itself. And B, I'm going to take that and run with it because I saw this dude do it.
Mm-hmm.
And those are two very important points, because we do, in the adult industry, teach many people about sex, about women, about how to deal with women, and all that stuff. You know, and it's gone from that sort of thing to spit in her mouth and let's see how many dicks can get in her ass, which is a shame. That stuff used to be the fringe and now it's the mainstream. I think it is a little bit of the YouTubing of entertainment in general. We don't sit for a full story. And then and I'm sure you've heard people say this, oh, nobody watches the plot. Nobody wants to see the plot. Nobody cares.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
They just want to see, you know. And if that's the case, then have you watched the movie Monsters Ball?
Yeah.
Did you watch the whole thing, or did you just flip to the Holly Berry sex scene?
Kind of a mixture of both. I was initially curious to see the film, honestly, because of the sex scene I heard about.
Right.
But it ended up being a very engaging movie for me, so I watched the whole thing.
What I'm saying is, when you put it in the DVD player, I almost said VCR, dating myself, when you put it in the 8-track, when you did the reel-to-reel for Monsters Ball, did you immediately go to...
No, I can honestly say no.
Make it feel good. Or did you start it from the beginning?
I started it from the beginning, yeah.
Now, having watched it, do you think that the sex scene would have been as powerful if you had just gone to it, you know,
no,
without any setup, without any pretense, without anything?
Me, no.
And that's true for... I won't say everyone, but the vast majority of people, these same people that say nobody cares about plot, nobody cares about plot. If that's the case, why do we go to movies?
That's a good question.
Ever. Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Okay, I think they had sex in the kitchen or whatever. This just have Brad Pitt and Angelina humping each other in the kitchen. Why do you need all the gunfight? For what? Nobody wants to watch that. Why do we watch? Because, you know, generally speaking, it's good. If it's not good, we don't watch. Generally speaking, in porn, it's not good. Why? Because you don't have writers anymore. And that's why Nina Hartley told you, good luck. Because
yeah, I'm glad you brought up Nina Hartley or that workshop, because, again, that's over half of what motivated me to want to get in the film. Is, you know, was not, again, I didn't really have a desire to be a performer. I wouldn't even say necessarily even a producer. I wanted to be basically what you're doing now. I wanted to be either a combination director and screenwriter, or at bare minimum, I just wanted to be a writer. I wanted to kind of bring back, because I knew from the popularity of the erotic fantasies I used to write, like I would have women literally read my fantasies and masturbate like 2-3 times a day every day.
Mm-hmm.
I had like women would tell me, Alan, I had to go to the bathroom like twice at work because I don't read no fantasy, and it got me off. And I think you see that now with the popularity of erotica. The USA Today did a story how erotica has like just blown up.
Yes, and it's a pendulum, and it is swinging back slowly, but it's swinging back at a time where the adult industry isn't doing very well. And so certainly it's not worried about spending, you know, where average gonzo movie is $15,000, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000, $90,000 on a movie. They want to make their money and run because they, you know, no one in the industry really knows what's going to happen, and everyone is suffering. And because they've been slow to embrace the internet, they'd rather be at war with it than embrace it and figure out how to make money off of it. The two sites have gotten a big jump on them. And in terms of erotica, I'm addicted to quite a few cable shows, Big Love and Weeds, and you watch these shows, and they're encroaching on my little field. I'm like, wait a second. I mean, you've got these stars taking their tops off and humping and doing everything else. And I'm like, hold on a second. So they've gotten smart, and they said, okay, the porn industry doesn't want to do it. We're going to do it.
Yeah, because I love, have you heard of the name Zalman King?
Hmm?
Have you heard of the name Zalman King?
No.
Oh, look him up. I love Zalman King. Some people have nicknamed him the king of soft porn.
Mm-hmm.
And he knows how to write stories. Like, one of his most notable was this Showtime series that used to star David Duchovny from The X-Files and Californication. It's called Red Shoe Diaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, Zalman King was the writer and producer of that. And yeah, I'm a big fan of his. Matter of fact, one of my email addresses is the Black Zalman King. But yeah, I'm all, like, if I would have got into the adult film industry and started making film, I would have been very similar. Did you see Boogie Nights?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Burt Reynolds' character, which he actually got nominated for an Oscar for his character.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that made his character interesting and entertaining is that he wasn't trying to make the quick buck. He literally looked at his films as art. He treated his films the way Francis Ford Coppola looked at The Godfather, you know, or Martin Scorsese looked at his films. He wanted his films to be memorable. But matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, that was a subplot of that movie, was that he kind of got caught up in that transition period,
mm-hmm,
where people were looking for more just short vignettes. I don't know if that's the way you pronounce it.
Yeah, vignettes.
Vignettes. Yeah, as opposed to, like, you know, the full features. And go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, and you can do a great vignette series. And I understand the arguments, because I know how much it costs to do a feature versus what you can realistically sell these days. And so, you know, you'd go broke, and companies have come through and said, oh, we're going to bring back the feature. And they've been gone in a year because there's no outlet. You cannot, in this climate, you cannot make your money back. And that doesn't have very much to do with the consumer, because the way porn is shot, it has nothing to do with the consumer. Everyone gets paid by the time you take that movie home. And so, essentially, we can sell a blank tape. We don't care, because we've already been paid. It's not like receipts at a theater, you know, or DVD sales of mainstream stuff at Blockbuster, what have you. It's because we don't do, obviously, any outside advertising. Let's say there's a movie that goes straight to DVD. Lion King 3 or whatever. You're going to hear about it on television. You're going to hear about it on the radio. You're going to say, oh, yeah, you know, that's an internet, whatever. You might be on a mailing list. They might mail it to you. Oh, yeah, that's coming out. I remember. It's coming out on Tuesday. I got to go get it. We don't have outlets like that. And generally speaking, people that still go to the video store, they go to one store, maybe two. And they're still trying to, you know, sneak in the back and make sure nobody sees them and all this junk. And they're going to pick up something from that store. If their favorite store goes completely gay overnight, they're going to pick the man that looks the most like a woman and take that home. Because it's not like, you know, oh, I want to buy a new garbage can, so I'm going to go to Costco, and then I'm going to go to Bed Bath & Beyond, and I'm going to comparison shop and see what's here and see what's there. You don't do that with porn. You go to that one place, and they have held you captive for years. The internet has changed that, because you can basically type in, I want to see redheaded midget wearing blue stockings, you know, on fire, and you can get it, and you don't have to leave the house. And that was a fundamental change. The reason the industry was so successful for so many years is that it was a monopoly, or at best an oligopoly. We decided what you watched, and the industry does not know how to deal with that major shift that puts the power in the hands of the consumer, because we've never wanted to make friends with the consumer. In fact, we've lied to the consumer several times. I remember there were movies at the video store that I worked at that were made in the late 80s, early 90s, where they would hire a girl who was not even in the adult industry to pose for the cover, but she wasn't in the movie. And people would spend their hard-earned money and take these movies home, and they would get gypped, and they would get lied to.
Interesting.
So I think if we hadn't done that for so many years, there would be a sense of loyalty, and there would be a sense of, yeah, okay, I've got to pay for this, you know, like with artists. Sure, there's some people that are going to bootleg and whatever, but if you're a fan of, say, Prince, or if you're a fan of, you know, whoever, you're going to go and spend the money. And there's enough people like that to where it stays alive. But we have caused the consumer to hate us. And so as soon as there was an opportunity that didn't involve going to the video store, they were with it. They have no loyalty to us because we never had any loyalty to them.
That's a valid point. Very valid point. Is there anybody you would be willing to say on record that they just did not, you weren't feeling them when you had a scene, when you just was like, man, I'd never work with that person again? Either on the performing end, producing end, business. Is there any name of a person you would be willing to say on my show that, hey, I, you know, XYZ person, I would, you know, he's a great whatever, but I personally would never work with that person again?
I would not, and I'll say because there's no way, I can't say they're, you know, oh, they're a great person, but I would never work with them. It would be disingenuous.
Okay.
I wouldn't work with them again because obviously they were an asshole, or they were, you know, not able to do the job or whatever the case. And there's so much of that damages people's pocket that I don't, you know, I don't want to be responsible for somebody losing work because of something that I said.
Yeah, I got you.
Everyone is going to have their own experiences and opinions about people. There's people that are in the industry that are supposedly, you know, best things since sliced bread, and they just, for whatever reason, don't work out on my set. There's people that everyone else has written off and said is horrible that do great jobs for me.
I'm going to put you on the spot here. Since you brought that up, this was going to be one of my things I was going to do actually a little later, but I'm going to do it now since you kind of gave me a nice segue. We're going to play a game. I'm going to throw out some names to you.
Oh, Lord.
And I want you to
I'm going
to
prove how dumb the industry is right now.
I want you to give me a one or two sentence comment of each name, if you've interacted. Now, I'm just assuming you've interacted with some of these people, so if you haven't, then of course you would just say, I've never really interacted with that person.
Okay.
And secondly, if you know you're going to say something really negative, but you don't want it on air, you can just say, hey, I no comment or something to that effect.
In terms of porn, I'm a bitter old woman. Like, I'm at the age, like, I'm the grandma of porn, so there's not much that I won't say. And that I haven't said to the person to their face anyway.
Okay, I'm going to throw out a few names. Like I said, some of these names, you might not even work with these people directly. You might just know them casually. But I'm going to throw out some names, okay? Jake Steed. She laughs.
I have worked with him.
Okay.
He was, like, my third or fourth scene in the business. This was before I had even moved to L.A. And
You had a scene with him before you moved to L.A.? How did that happen?
Well, I came out here to see, you know, to try to sell my movie and see if wanted to move. I didn't just move out here because I was coming strictly to be part of this industry. So I kind of, you know, we flew out to do a test run and, you know, see if we liked it. And during that time, I did some scenes and I was like, okay, let me see if I can do this performing thing. And so in that vein, I worked with him for his own company. Jay Steed was one of the first, if not the first, he may have been the first black man to own and have worldwide distribution of his own content.
Hmm.
And for that, I respect him because he made it possible for a lot of people to come behind him. No pun intended.
I like those puns.
I like success stories.
Yeah, I get that impression.
It gives people a blueprint. I mean, I didn't have a blueprint when I came in, so it's nice that other people get to come in behind and say, okay, this can be done because this person did it and this person did it.
Interesting. Uh-huh. Okay. Mr. Marcus. I'm a giggle.
Oh, my goodness. Mr. Marcus. Probably behind Jenna Jameson, but in front of Ron Jeremy. So I'd say probably the most recognizable male adult star in the world.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Have you worked with him?
Yeah. I worked with him when he still had Mr. Marcus's Neighborhood for Vivid. I was in the very last Mr. Marcus's Neighborhood, the very last production that Vivid let a black person helm.
Mm-hmm. Let-
and I was not I was not completely pleased about that. But
Lexington Steel.
Lexington Steel, I did my first scene with, and I had done several scenes with. I liked working with him. He had good energy. I'm sort of weird in that if I find somebody that I like performing with, I didn't want to hang out with them socially because I would be afraid I'd find out something, like, just stupid or goofy about them that would make it impossible for me to really take them seriously the next time we work together. So, you know, you knew I liked working with you if I would just, like, never hang out with you ever. And so that was...
Well, you know, that's funny you say that because, again, I have a background in the entertainment industry. I know that happens actually with mainstream films.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of actors and actresses will actually, some have said it in interviews and definitely they've said it when I've had private conversations with them. Like, a lot of actors and actresses, if they know that they're going to be in a movie, say, where they're going to be, like, lovers, husband and wife, and particularly
mm-hmm.
if they're going to have love scenes, that's the attitude they have. They said that they don't like hanging out with that person too much.
Yeah, because you're afraid you're going to find... You might be arguing about health care or who's hotter, Ginger or Marianne, and it just takes something dumb like that to just throw off the entire chemistry.
Oh, yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, not that I've had extensive experience putting that to use, but I just know from just my observation and experience that, yeah, little things can throw off.
Well, chemistry. To put it in a real life sense, I'm sure with all the women you've talked to, you must have talked to women that told you a story about a guy who literally talked himself out of some pussy.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she was all ready to do it, and they go to dinner, and they start talking, and he just says something just outlandishly ignorant. And she's like, oh, man, why didn't you just shut up? Cool.
That's a very good point that male listeners listening to the show take notes. I've heard more women, because women always say, they say, Alan, there's a lot of men who believe that they can talk their way into your pants. But the reality is there are more men who actually talk themselves out of your pants. And so, yeah, I've heard that from a number one. They say, Alan, I would have been more likely to get this guy some pussy if he had left it at a 5 to 10 minute conversation
mm-hmm.
than him talking for 2 hours and ended up saying something or revealing something that just totally killed it.
Well, here's the thing, and women sometimes don't want to admit this to themselves, and men certainly don't want to admit it. Women have already decided. You knew when you left the house whether you were going to have sex with him, and that's why you wore your special panties or brushed your teeth extra hard or put your diaphragm in or whatever it is you did, or decided, you know, yeah, I am going to have that third or fourth drink so I can be drunk enough to say, oh, that was junk. You know, whatever your little methodology is, you've already decided. So all guys have to do is maintain. You don't have to talk her into it because you didn't talk her into it. Trust and believe.
Shawn Michaels.
Shawn Michaels is another one. I believe he was the second black person to have control of his own distribution and whatnot of his product. And, you know, he's considered a legend. I believe he's in the Hall of Fame. He has he doesn't just go into a scene blindly. He has a certain method because he wants to elicit a certain response from the woman. So, you know, he puts thought into what he does, which is nice.
Ron Hightower...
I got here too late to know him as a performer. I got here post How Do You Want It video. And so by the time I got to L.A., he was a music video director. And so I don't, you know, other than, you know, casually meeting him or whatever, I didn't have much dealing with him when it comes to the adult industry.
I've mentioned this name quite a few times already, Nina Hartley.
Oh, Nina. Nina was one of the people that I had admired before I got here. You know, I had this kind of list. I was like, okay, I'm going to be like her and her and her and her, you know, when I came here. Because I studied porn, and I was like, okay, Jenna Jameson, she's the most popular person in the world. Let me see why. Let me watch her scenes. Let me see if there's some special twist or kick or something she does. You know, what is it? Why? So that I can, you know, incorporate it, improve upon it, whatever the case may be. And Nina Hartley was, I mean, everyone at the store I worked at was just in love with her. And I met her not too long after I got here, but I actually got to work with her in one of the very last scenes I did, and it was awesome. And we just completely clicked. And it was funny because our pussies look exactly alike. It's just different colors. But I mean, the shape of the lips and everything. We were tripping out. We were sitting there just staring at each other's snatches for a while.
You're going to have to say that again. You guys got the same what?
We have the same pussy. We have it. She's, you know, hers is white and mine is dark. But other than that, the lips and everything look exactly the same. So we were tripping out for a while just staring at each other's pussies for the longest time because they both look the same.
Now, you know, you said that like the nerd you said you were. You said that like you just came out of accounting class. Hey,
Nina Hartley and I were staring at each other's pussies for the longest time because they both looked the same. So we were just sitting there fascinated. And then, of course, you know, we got our scene on, and that was even greater, and it was just an honor to work with her.
We got to lick each other's pussies.
We got to lick each other's pussies. We got to finger each other's pussies. We got to do a lot to each other that day. And singularly, I think she was the best girl-on-girl scene I've had, and I didn't expect any less. I knew. I was like, she is going to turn me out. I know already, and now I'm going to be stalking this woman, and it's going to be horrible. It's going to be restraining order time.
Would you say she's in your top three best pussy lickers you've ever had?
Nina was the top pussy licker I've ever had. Ooh. The top. The best.
Ooh. Like,
bar none.
Did you lick her pussy real well?
I think I licked her pussy pretty well. I think she says she had a good time. She said she still remembers it. We talk every now and then, and yeah, she mentions it. So it's an honor to be remembered because she's certainly had some lofty company.
Oh, for me to be remembered
up in there is nice. I think I did a pretty good job on her licking her pussy. Alan, I love to be remembered for licking pussy really well.
Mm-hmm. Which do you think you do better, sucking dick or licking pussy?
I definitely suck dick better than I lick pussy, mostly because I've had more dick. And dick sucking, it's because it's external rather than internal. You can definitely see what is working and what isn't. Having eaten a lot of pussy, having sucked a lot of dick, I can certainly empathize with men not knowing exactly when their woman is getting off because it's all internal. It's hard to tell. You just have to keep working at it.
Yes, I would agree with that because I think I've worked on it the last 20 years, but I think I've now got to perfect it.
And I don't think you ever have it perfected except for that particular person.
Mm.
You get a new person, it's a whole new class.
Oh, yeah, that's a very good point, David. Mm-hmm. Yes, I've definitely, I don't think I've seen your pussy-licking skills yet, but I'm going to have to check that out. But I've definitely seen your dick-sucking skills.
Yeah, I'm pretty good on the dick-sucking, I should say. I've had gay men come up to me and tell me that they learn how to suck dick from my movies.
Ooh.
And that is a compliment. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, I bet you enjoy watching me suck dick, don't you?
Very much so.
What do you like best about it?
Yeah.
What do you like? What to you distinguishes me from all the other dick suckers?
I like the way, number one, you have a way of using your eyes in a certain way. I'm big on eyes. And I like that a lot of the times when you're sucking dick, you look up at a guy in a certain way. And that's like a major turn on. And you don't act like you're in a hurry per se. Like some women, they suck a dick like somebody's there with a stopwatch. And you're very thorough, very slow and patient and thorough.
Well, thank you. I like to be thorough with everything I do, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, I love to fuck.
Mm. Say that again.
Alan, I love to fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Alan, I bet you're stroking your dick right now, aren't you? Aren't you?
Oh, yeah.
As you should be.
Hmm. As much tongues as you get on your pussy and dick as you get in your pussy, you probably never have time to just play with your pussy, do you?
I play with my pussy all the time, Alan.
Really?
I can always make time for that.
Ooh.
Alan, I always make time to play with my pussy. You can't leave that out of the equation. You got to put that in the schedule. Alan, I bet you want me to play with my pussy, don't you?
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love to visualize you taking. Well, all right, well, first let me ask you, are you, when you play with your pussy, are you more of a finger woman or a vibrator / dildo woman or equal balance of both?
I'm purely vibrator, purely.
Mm.
Yep. I'm a vibrator woman. I just stick that sucker on there and go.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's even better with penis.
Oh, so you said you like to have a dick in the pussy and a vibrator on it, too.
I like to have a dick in the pussy with a vibrator on it, too. That's the best. And the best.
Mm. Tell me about that sensation. What is it about that that really does it for you?
You know, it's hard to explain. I guess it's, well, the clitoris, I mean, it's going to respond to the vibrator. I mean, almost every woman's does, so that's really no big mystery. But the one thing about masturbation is, even though it gets you from point A to point B, there is absolutely no element of surprise. You know, you can't surprise yourself.
That's a good point.
Oh, I didn't know I was going to do that. You know, there's no spontaneity in there. So that's where the other person comes in. And that's really the only, to me, difference between masturbating and having a partner. If you can deal with the predictability of masturbation, I guess you don't ever need a partner.
Well, you know what I found is kind of, with phone sex as opposed to, say, me just being in the shower or laying in the bed by myself doing it, there is a certain unpredictability about it. Because for me, I never know where the woman is going to go. I mean, I know where I might want to lead her in the conversation, but she might go in a totally different direction, or she might go beyond the boundaries that I originally might have thought were there. So,
well, anytime you add another person in.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's telling, yeah, another person.
Yeah, you're adding something that's outside of yourself, you know. You're going to have that.
Now, I would think you, being both a performer and a director, you've probably either experienced or at minimum observed probably every fantasy you could ever imagine. Is there any fantasy that you've entertained in your mind that you either, A, haven't experienced yourself, or B, haven't filmed someone else doing it?
Oh, there's a great many things I haven't shot somebody else doing. But in terms of personal fantasies, I'm really not, this is going to surprise you, but I'm not a hugely visual person.
Really?
My fantasies are never, they're not fantasies, in that fantasies denote something that I couldn't do for some reason, or feel that I shouldn't do for some reason. And so the things that I want to do, I do with my partner. And I'll be completely honest, and I know this isn't totally sexy, but I'm, surprisingly, I guess some people would say vanilla in terms of my sex at home.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
I find that hard to believe.
I mean, I'm not standing on my head, and here's the thing. It's like hearing that pro wrestling is fake. Most of those positions that we do are not conducive to orgasm.
Oh, yeah. I was told that when I lived in L.A. And then, yeah, a few people, because I knew at least a handful of people that worked in the industry, and it actually reminded me of real film, because I'm sure, you know, real film, there's a lot of, well, I should say real film, that's like saying porno was unreal, I should say mainstream film. It so involves so many little small shots that are many times uncomfortable for the actor and or actress, including love scene,
mm-hmm.
that, yeah, it's totally for, you know, when you put it all together through editing, of course, it's a fluid thing that looks well for the person viewing it and they enjoy it. But, yeah, I'm feeling what you're saying about how, yeah, it's probably not realistically enjoyable for, you know, if you're trying to do it at home or whatever.
Right, right. And people try to. And I've gotten, I don't know how many emails and things like, I tried that thing with the leg behind the head and that was some bullshit. I'm like, well, I didn't tell you to, dude. Didn't it look like some bullshit to you? Why'd you do it?
What type, like you were asking me about, you know, what did I like about watching you suck dick? What type of adrenaline rush did you get as a performer, knowing that there were men at home stroking their dicks watching you, and women playing with their pussies watching?
Honestly, that, although it was in my consciousness, because to me, a good performer keeps that in mind above all, because unfortunately, it's not what you're doing, it's what you're acting like you're doing. You get what I mean?
Name 2 to 3 positions based on, I don't know how much feedback you solicit from viewers of your films, but in terms of both scenarios as well as position, what do people, men and or women, tell you that turns them on the most?
You know, it's never a matter of a particular position. I get emails all the time about certain scenarios. Many of them have to do with taboos, like being caught doing something or being outside doing something, you know, that sort of thing. Because again, you know, pseudo-puritanical society, we're caught up in that. We're caught up in the it's evil, I got caught thing of porn, which is why people have affairs. But it's more, they want to see 2 people that really are into each other. And that's men and women across the board. And that sounds like a very simplistic answer, but sex, in its essence, if it's done right, it's simple. You shouldn't really have to do too much work. If you're working really hard, you're probably doing something wrong.
Man, that's a damn good point. You're full of damn good points. Yeah, so the one scenario is like a kind of the forbidden taboo type of thing. I'm sitting here trying to think of. Do you get off more on female-female scenes or male-female scenes, or are they kind of equal?
I can say that, and this is what I'm talking about, being an old woman and not caring what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I have not had an orgasm during a scene.
Wow, that's interesting. That's another strong statement. Wow.
It's not that I was particularly trying to or not trying to. It just hasn't happened.
Yeah, you talking about both genders or just men?
Both.
Wow.
Look, I haven't been with a woman that's made me come. Except for, Nina Hartley got damn close. Nina Hartley got damn close.
Because she was
I think
one.
Had we not been doing a scene, had we not had to shift positions and do this and do that, it probably would have happened. Nina probably would have made me come by licking my pussy if we had been having private time somewhere.
Did you make her come by licking her pussy?
I don't think I made her come by licking her pussy. I wanted her to come, yes. Alan, I wanted to make her pussy come. I really did. We just didn't have quite enough time.
So you love having Nina lick your pussy and you like licking her pussy?
Hold on. We're getting off track from the actual question, which, I mean, I can't even remember right now, but it was something. The point is, you are distracting me, and I don't want to just, you know, start stroking my pussy right now or anything.
You don't want to start stroking what?
I said, I don't want to start stroking my pussy right now or anything. I need to answer the question.
You don't want to start stroking.
I don't even know what the question was. You got me messed up right now.
You want to play with what?
My pussy. Alan, I want to play with my pussy real good. Alan, I would love to come for you while I'm playing with my pussy.
Ooh, and a vibrator all on your clit. Mm-hmm.
So you know I do like that vibrator on me.
You love that vibrator, don't you?
Mm-hmm. Alan, I love that vibrator on my pussy.
Say it again.
Alan, I love that vibrator on my pussy. Oh, Alan, that gets my pussy wet.
Oh, I love to watch Nina just sucking on your pussy while you got that vibrator on it, too.
I would love to have Nina sucking on my pussy while I had the vibrator on it.
Say that again. You'd love to have it.
I would love to have Nina suck on my pussy while I had the vibrator on it.
Now, you were talking earlier about the viewer get off if they see genuine passion. A female friend of mine sent me this clip just a few weeks ago. And I was just telling you earlier in the conversation, I don't really like clips where they just basically start off fucking.
Mm-hmm.
But this couple seemed to be just really having a good time with each other. And just so happens that when I do research on the guy, you know, much has been made about Diana Ross discovering Michael Jackson, even though I know, being from Gary, that's not true. Diana Ross didn't really discover Michael Jackson. But I did some research and found this guy was discovered by you. You were like his like mentor. His name is Justin Slayer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was in this scene with this young lady named goes by the name Sabera Mara or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that was pretty hot. So tell me and my listeners, how did you like discover him?
I went to a party with my ex swing party that he wanted to go to. So I met Justin Slayer at a swingers party that my ex wanted to go to. It was for black men and white women, so why was I there? But I was sitting in the ante room of the house, which is just a fancy way of saying foyer or place where they were not fucking or lobby, you know, type of place, you know, where you first enter the house.
Okay.
Because the screwing was in the back.
Okay.
He came out to get a drink of water or whatever, and I was, and generally, people at swingers parties are not, by and large, the most attractive people ever.
Now that is Diana being real.
And
you just shattered a lot of people's images.
Y'all people who are listening to this and go to swing clubs know. And the bigger and the older you are, the faster you strip down to that towel. And I mean, I won't say I don't get it. Wonderful for you and your body image, and it's great, and it's fine, but let's be real, that is what it is. It's not a whole bunch of Elle McPherson's running around. It just isn't. Anyway.
Yeah, well, I've got to say a quick point on that. Yeah, I've been invited a handful of times, and two times in particular where I was being strongly persuaded to go. And in both of those two instances, that's what actually turned me off. One was in California, one was since I've been back here in the Midwest. It was during the internet age, so they had, like, a site where you could see, like, a lot of the members
mm-hmm.
on the internet who were going to be there. And honestly, like,
they fucked up when they did that.
75 to 90% were just not attractive. Attracted to me. I'm sure they were attracted to somebody, but for me, I was like, oh, hell no. I'm not, And so, yeah, that
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the swinger life. And you've got to, you see it in the few new beaches that are in America. The people that are running to take their clothes off and stuff, they're not the people you want to see nude, generally speaking.
Oh, Diana, you got a good sense of humor and wit about you.
Oh, I know that sounds really mean, but in any case, so, and we know Slayer is rather attractive, so I was like, hey, you don't fit in here, what are you doing here? So we started talking, and he was telling me, yeah, he's visiting LA for this, that, and the third, and I was like, well, how long have you been swinging? He goes, yeah, you know, I go around, and this lady at this particular party was shooting a gangbang for her amateur website, so her husband is shooting, and she's, you know, taking all the dick and whatnot. And he was in the gangbang, so that was going to end up being on this lady's side, and she was going to make a certain amount of money from it. So I said to him, why are you giving away for free? Have you ever thought about doing this, that, and the third? And he was like, well, yeah, but how do you get into the business, and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, well, leave that to us. So we got him in. We got him his first contract with West Coast Productions, and from there, he started his own company, JSI, and he's doing, you know, he was at Evil Angel for a while, and now he's totally independent. And he's doing great, and I'm proud of him.
Is there anything that a man and or a woman can look to adult films to help? Because I've had discussions where people say it can go both ways, a double-edged sword. Porn can either enhance a couple's sex life, or it can hurt it. Usually hurt it if one of the two people get really addicted to it. What do you think that they can take away from a good quality adult film and that can help their love life, say a married couple or a couple long-term relationship? Is there anything that they can learn or not really?
I think at best, porn is a great visual aid for people who want to fulfill certain fantasies. Let's say you want to have sex on a rooftop, but obviously you can't because you don't want to get arrested or whatever. And you can live that through a porn movie showing that rooftop sex scene. That's great. I think that would be the most positive way to use porn in a relationship. Obviously, the most negative way comes from one person liking and using porn and the other person not being very jazzed about that person using porn, you know, because that brings in trust issues. And that usually comes from insecurity from the party that doesn't like porn. Oh, she's prettier than I am. Oh, you must, you know, they consider it akin to cheating.
Mm-hmm.
But porn is completely utilitarian. It's not, by its nature, it's not art. Porn can be artistic, but porn can never be art.
Another classic strong statement by Diana. You got some gems, man. You got some gems. Any relationship is challenging in its own right. That's what I deal with on my other show. It's just I talk to authors and experts that deal with dating and relationships, and we cover different, you know, facets of the relationships. But it has to be very interesting to maintain a relationship when you're in that industry. Now, I would think it's a little bit easier if both people in a relationship are in the business, but I would
definitely think so.
Challenging if one person is in and one person is out. What are your general thoughts about maintaining a relationship when you work in the adult film industry?
It's the same as maintaining a relationship outside of the adult industry. You either have to have complete trust and acceptance, or at least accept that you don't trust the person. I think one of the most valuable lessons I've ever learned in life is that you can have a fabulous relationship, I mean, you know, friendship, relationship, whatever, you know, type, with somebody that you don't trust, if you just keep in mind that there isn't any trust there. Because without trust, there's no expectation. And without expectation...
It sounds interesting the way you said that, but it sounds valid.
Without trust, there's no expectation. And without expectation, you won't be hurt or disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. And that, to me, goes for almost all relationships. Business relationship, you know, anything.
Okay, well, let me get a little personal.
Crook, if you know he a crook.
Let me get a little personal here. Has there ever been an instance, say, over the past 10 or 15 years, where one of these two, if not both, happened, where you were dating someone and you found yourself, if only for 24 hours, insanely jealous about the interaction, whether it was on camera or off, or vice versa, the guy you were dating was insanely jealous about either he felt like you had a whole bunch of chemistry with your fellow performer on screen, or he felt like there was a chemistry you guys had off screen? Or has that never happened?
Well, it happened with me before I got into the industry with my ex, Alexander DeVoe.
You used to be married to Alexander DeVoe.
I was never married to him.
Oh, then Google is up there lying on you then.
Oh, yeah. If you Wikipedia me, it's a whole bunch of coolness. It's about 70% true, and I just don't even care. So we were together for 8 years, and it was because our relationship was not defined. So there were certain things that he would do that I didn't like, but it was okay. But certain things that, you know, if I even said I was going to go out to the club, then it was a problem. And I'm like, but you're doing this, that, and the third. Like, he was a swinger. I was not. And because our relationship was not defined, it was like, okay, if these are the rules, then I know I can't get jealous, or at least there's no point in getting jealous because this is how this is. But if it's not defined, then you don't know the parameters of what your appropriate responses to things are.
Now, you know, you just almost indirectly promoted my second book. My second book is called Upfront and Straightforward, just like my other radio show. And towards the back of the book, I try not to give too much relationship advice. My advice is usually for single men, single women, because for one thing, I'm not currently in a serious relationship, and I don't have a PhD in relationship psychology, so I feel like it's, you know, credibility issue. But there's one chapter where I do give some, and that's one of the things I say, I believe in order to have a successful relationship with anyone, you have to have specifically defined roles and guidelines. You have to know what your role. It's just like to me in business or any other relationship. You know, one reason why I feel sports teams win championships is because everybody knows their role.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that applies to romantic relationships. I think if you're in a man in a relationship, you got to know what your role is. Same with the woman. And I think if your roles are vague, to me, it opens the door to a lot. It opens a can of worms.
And many men and some women, you know, they like vagueness and foster vagueness because it makes it seem like they haven't committed to the person or they don't owe the person anything. But I mean, if you have a situation, let's say, where you are over this person's house every single day, you know, you're basically sleeping together every night. You may not live together, but you spend an awful lot of time together. And then, you know, one day, one Friday night or whatever, you don't come over because you're going out with Susie Sunshine. Okay, yeah, that person is going to be mad because you implied a certain thing by your action. And you did not specifically say, bitch, you a booty call, don't get it twisted. And if you say that and she says okay and then she flips out, then yes, she's crazy and you can tell all your boys, don't fuck with her the she cycle. But if you just, you know, did this little implied thing and then pulled that stuff, then it's your fault.
I feel like you took me to class. So we're going to definitely have to stay in contact because I want to just be a sponge and just, yeah, you know your shit.
As you know yours. It was fun performing because I got to be somebody I wasn't. I got to act. If I wasn't so lazy, I would have been an actress. I love acting. I'm good at it. But it wasn't my passion, and so I wasn't going to do the cattle calls and everything necessary to do that.
Well, Diana, it's an understatement to say it's been a pleasure.
All right, it was nice talking to you. I'll talk to you soon.
This episode of The Erotic Conversationalist was produced by Alan Roger Curry for Mode One Multimedia Incorporated.